Are you ready for a whole new way of being in the world? Welcome to Living from the Inside Out with Michael Neal.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you may be. Our topic for today is the kindness of fear, and I will be taking your calls throughout the show. And if you don't know the numbers, neither do I, but I'm going to get them to you shortly. I'm in a different studio today. I'm actually flying off to Finland after the show to speak at a conference called Unlimited 2016. And you can probably find that online. I think there's a live stream that you can tap into for that in Helsinki. But if you want to talk to me live, numbers to call 866-254-1579, toll free in the United States and Canada. That's 866-254-1579. And then from outside of the United States, you can reach the show by dialing 001-760-918-4300. But as always, before going to the phone, I'm going to set the table. And today, before setting the table, I'm going to tell you about a new program we got coming up. It's actually a new version of our most popular program, Creating the Impossible. And so I'm very happy this morning we sent out an email announcing Creating the Impossible 2017. And there's a few things that are going to be different about this. The first is I'm in the midst of writing the book of the Creating the Impossible program for Hay House. So next September, we're going to be bringing out a Creating the Impossible book. And so this program is going to be the last pre-publication version of the program. So bits of what happened in the program, with permission, I will be sharing in the book. So it's a chance to participate at that level. And we've got a massive welcome sale. So if you check out creatingtheimpossible.net, it'll tell you all about the program. It'll show you two ways that you can join the program at a massive discount. And I hope you'll join us for it. It's an amazing community, and it's an amazing chance to kind of kick off the new year in full creator's mode. So today's show is called The Kindness of Fear. And I wrote about this recently on Caffeine for the Soul, and it was a bit of a shock to me when I was talking to one of my mentors. And she was talking about fear. She was talking about fear as if it was a wonderful thing. She's saying, "Oh, isn't it so lovely that we have fear?" And I was just thinking, okay, I kind of know she's not completely nuts because of other things she said, but that makes no sense to me. And it was in the midst of a larger conversation, so at the time I didn't even comment on it, but I flagged it, and I even jotted something down in my notebook with a question mark and a kind of a note to myself to ask her about it next time we spoke. And the reason that it seemed kind of nuts is because I'm somebody who spent a lot of my life afraid, you know, kind of afraid of my own shadow. Now, people don't always believe that because I've done a lot in the world. And the truth is, I just, you know, never particularly stopped me from doing things, but it just made it uncomfortable to be alive. And so I had gotten to a point with fear as I began to see that we live in a world of thought and that we live in the feeling of our thinking, not the feeling of an external world. Fear stopped being like an important message about I should do this or I shouldn't do this. And, you know, if you can't, you must. Or if you're scared, it's telling you something smart. Don't do it. I had just tried every psychological approach to dealing with fear that I could find. And then when I really started seeing the nature of thought and the transient nature of thought, how thought comes and goes, and as thought comes and goes, fear comes and goes with it, if it happens to be fearful thought. I got less afraid of fear, and that did me a world of good. I got more willing to just be scared when I was scared and not make it mean anything. And it became, and you've probably heard, if you listen to the show regularly, you probably heard me talk about fear like somebody wearing a red t-shirt. Right? It's like, so what? Oh, I can't do this. Why not? There's a guy wearing a red t-shirt over there. Okay. Right. Oh, I was going to do it, but then a guy walked in with a red t-shirt on. So now I'm not going to do it. I was going to ask her to marry me, but she was wearing a red T-shirt, so nothing I could do. You know, my bad. And it did. It felt like that. Like that was just me trying to express what it felt like, not as a sort of a psychological trick. It just stopped feeling like a big deal. Sometimes I was scared. Sometimes I wasn't. And so I'd made my peace with it in the way you make your peace with hiccups, right? It's like they're a little annoying. You don't really want hiccups. They're kind of weird, but you know they pass. And just most of the time, you just kind of get on with it as best you can. And so I was puzzled. I was intrigued at the idea that this woman who I respected thought of fear as a lovely thing, as a gift. And I even thought to myself, oh, well, you know, she's a little backwards maybe in this area, right? You know, I've evolved beyond her understanding of fear with my red T-shirt understanding of fear. But by the same token, something in me obviously knew that that might not be true because I didn't dismiss it. And I did talk with her about it. And she explained it to me. She said that fear and discouragement and overwhelm and all those kinds of feelings are your psychological early warning systems that your thinking is going off the rails. Like, you know, rumble strips on a road, and I've used this analogy before, but like a rumble strip, you know, if your car starts to drift out of your lane, it makes the car shake. And that sort of wakes you up. It wakes you up out of your head trance or wakes you up literally if you're falling asleep late at night so that you don't go off the road. Well, that is what fear is. Fear is a rumble strip letting you know, hey, your thinking's going off the road. If you keep driving after you go over a rumble strip, if you don't get back in lane, you will go off the road. And chances are bad things happen, right? Well, if you keep thinking the way you're thinking when you're afraid, your thinking's going to go off the road and there'll be consequences to that. Right? As she was talking, the analogy that came to me was pain. Right? When you put your hand on something hot, the body knows to take your hand off it because it'll get burned if it stays there. Well, so in that sense, fear is like a small psychological pain to save you from a larger one if you don't do something about it, right? People who don't feel pain get injured a lot. Right? People who've learned to override their pain might be good at contact sports, but they also tend to spend the second half of their lives somewhat crippled. Well, psychologically, what I had done for most of the early part of my life was I toughened up. So I'd learned to ignore fear in a tough, I don't have to be, it doesn't matter that I feel scared kind of a way. And it took a toll on me psychologically. I suffered from depression. I suffered from exhaustion. I just suffered. And then I got to a point where I didn't suffer from it in the same way, but it was like an unwelcome guest that came to visit me, sometimes regularly, sometimes not so regularly. And for the first time in this conversation, I started to see, oh, hang on. This is actually telling me something, but it's not telling me about what I need to do or not do in the world. It's not a traffic light saying, don't go down this road or go faster down this road because you're scared. That's telling you, right? I've heard all those psychological theories. What fear and discouragement and disappointment and overwhelm and all those kinds of feelings are telling you is you don't want to keep thinking that way. You want to make space for something new to come through. For a better thought to come along, a different thought to come along. You don't need to do it manually, right? The nature of thought is fluid. We're talking about this in a group. I'm finishing up with a group today, an infinite potential, infinite possibilities group. And we're talking about how thought is kind of like in quantum physics, where if you look at energy and you think you're going to see a particle, you see a particle. And you think you're going to see a wave, you see a wave. Well, if you think Thought is solid. It's fixed. It's immutable. It's a belief. It's something I have to do something about. It's an iceberg. Well, it appears solid. But if you see its fluid nature, it becomes more and more fluid. And the way you know that thought is fluid is you won't be thinking. You aren't thinking now what you were thinking when the show began. And you won't be thinking 5 minutes from now what you're thinking now, because thought is fluid. Now, you can get it back. You can force it. You can treat it as a solid, and then it behaves more like a solid. It's responsive in that way. But that's not its nature. Its nature is to be responsive in that way. And so the kindness of fear was something I had never seen before, that fear was part of the kindness of the human design. It's a way of our own psychology letting us know it's running amok. It's an early warning sign. It's like the sound the disposal makes in the kitchen. If there's something stuck in it, it starts making a kind of a grinding sound, and you know to switch it off and, you know, hopefully safely go in there and take out whatever's stuck in there before you run it. And if you don't, it will probably burn out. Well, if we don't listen to fear not telling us what to do or not do, but simply telling us, hey, you're going off the rails here, buddy. Hey, your thinking's kind of taking you away from your own wisdom. It's taking you away from healthy thinking, healthy psychological functioning. Well, then, you know, you'll burn out. You'll shut down. Like, that's, for me, how I think about depression. You know, as somebody who genuinely suffered from depression for 7 years and then experienced it with less suffering later on and hasn't experienced it for a long time. It really looks to me like the depression is like a hairdryer. And what I mean by that is that when you run a hairdryer, most hairdryers that I've seen have this function. If it overheats, it switches off. It's got like an override so that it overheats, it switches off before it can catch on fire. Well, when we live in anxious states of mind, when our minds are going a million miles a minute and we're living in fear and stress and anxiety all the time, the mind has an override and it just switches off. And most people describe it as like a dead feeling, an empty feeling, and they don't like it. And then you call it depression and it becomes an iceberg. It becomes a fixed thing you've got to reckon with. The reason the hairdryer won't let you switch it back on when it's overheated until it cools down is because that's the wisdom of the design, right? That's the kindness of the design. It won't let you set yourself on fire. Well, depression in that sense is part of the kindness of the design. It won't let you burn yourself out. Though we're pretty tough. We can override even that sometimes, force ourselves to keep going. Like, it's amazing. I can't remember now where I first heard this, but somebody pointed out to me, who's had been a family and marriage therapist for over 30 years, that most marriages could have been saved if one or both people were willing to take a nap more often. Right? Just at some level, it's this thing in us that thinks we have to keep pushing and pushing and pushing and pushing, no matter how loudly everything in us is saying, take a break. Just back off this line of thought for a while. Just make space and see what else comes through. Because that's the nature of thought. When we stop running with the thought we've got, there'll be a little lag, and then there'll be a new thought along in a minute. If you get off the bus you're on, there'll be another bus along, not going in that same direction. And so this was, for me, revelatory, that fear was part of the kindness of the design. It was telling me something really valuable. You don't want to keep thinking that. You want to pull back from that line of thought and let something new emerge. Now, notice, that doesn't mean don't think about what you're thinking about. It means you don't want to think it the way you're thinking it. So a lot of you know the story. If you've read Space Within, I tell the story. I've told the story on air before. But one of the most profound experiences I had was around a client who had a fear of death. And it was such a profound fear that it was ruining his life. He wasn't sleeping. He was getting ill. He was having problems at work because he was so scared of dying. And I, at the time, was sort of half inside out, half outside in. I didn't quite see that it's 100% thought created reality. I thought it was like a 90% thought created reality. So I was still kind of talking to him about, well, do you have a will in place? Do you have life insurance? And he did. And he made a couple of adjustments, but it didn't really make much of a difference. And then one day, out of sort of almost desperation, like lack of a better idea, I said to him, well, do you get scared and if you don't think about it? Like if you just don't think about death? And he went, well, no. And I said, well, maybe just don't think about it. And I went, Now, understand, I didn't think this was great coaching, right? I didn't go, ha-ha, another brilliant move by Michael Neal, right? I just thought, I don't know what else to say. Now, funnily enough, that really helped him. The next couple times I saw him, he'd slept. He was doing better than he'd done in months. But I thought, there's got to be something better than avoidance, right? I mean, I get that sticking your head in the sand can help a little, but that doesn't seem like a perfect long-term solution to anything, to everything, right? There's an old musical, Tovarich, that Vivien Leigh won the Tony for, and I don't know why I know this. Vivien Leigh won the Tony for it in 1963. Check it out. And there's a song in there. One of the characters sings about how he deals with his troubles in his life. And it's just, I go to bed. And that was his solution. Yeah, it just sleeps it off. It does actually kind of work, but it leads to a somewhat limited level of engagement with life. So I went to a different mentor. I went to a woman named Sandy Krott, who I was working with, and talked to her about it. And I said, well, what would you say to this guy who's sort of had such an overwhelming fear of death? And she said, well, I tell him he doesn't have to think about it. And I was like, yeah, that's what I told him. And, so he kind of huffed off. And I remember I kind of sat with that for a bit. And then I came back a couple hours later and I was like, no, that's not a good enough answer. I am not okay with that answer. Right. This can't be the best that we've got. In thousands of years of human evolution, the best we've got is stick your head in the sand and pretend it's not happening. And she said, well, what do you think I said? And I said, well, I heard what you said. I'd even written it down in my notebook. You said, you tell him that you don't have to think about that. And she said, no. I said, I tell him you don't have to think that. Now, at first, I didn't even know what she meant, but I had a profound, disturbing experience. Like my reality went Salvador Dali, those melting paintings. And suddenly I literally had the experience of reality melting. And it was, and I have no idea how long it lasted, but it felt like a very long time. And all of my ideas about what kind of person I am and what I was about in the world and they all started to kind of look like they were made up, which of course they were. And what was interesting to me, and this was obviously my brain's little way of giving me a metaphor, was that when my reality melted, there were only three things in it that didn't melt, like three rocks in a river of thought. And one was mind, divine mind and intelligence that was constant and ever available, and energy that was bringing everything to life, right? A power source. Another rock was consciousness, this capacity to know ourselves, this capacity to see what's going on at deeper and deeper levels and to experience life. And then the third rock was thought, this constant variable, this constant mental activity that's continually taking a, a thousand different forms and giving us a thousand different experiences of being alive. And I realized later on reflection that I thought death was a thing and I could have lots of different thoughts about it. But I didn't realize that death was made of thought too. And I didn't have to think death the way that I was used to thinking it. And when I shared this, when I went back and shared this with my client, he had an epiphany. He realized that, you know, look, neither of us were saying the body doesn't die. As far as we, either of us knew, the body died. But we both had made things up about death. We'd made up a world of thought about what death was and what it meant. So real to us that we didn't even question it. It was such a solid iceberg that we didn't recognize it was still made of water. It looked like such a solid belief that we didn't realize that it was just made up of thought. And when thought looks solid, it behaves like a solid, but when it looks fluid, it behaves like a fluid. And since its nature is fluid, it takes almost nothing for it to revert back to its fluid form. So I was saying to this group earlier today, it would be like an iceberg melting in 30 seconds, right before your eyes. Something that looked so solid and so real, and in a heartbeat, it's just part of the flow of thought again. And I remember one of the things my mentor saying was that for her, fear was an example of how well we're made. And I loved that expression, how well we're made. That built into our own psychology is this foolproof way to wake us up and give us the heads up that we might want to stop drifting in our thinking. And we might want to bring ourselves back and see what else came along. We might want to take ourselves off that train of thought and see what new train of thought came along. So numbers to call, 866-254-1579, toll free in the United States and Canada. Outside the U.S., you can reach the show by dialing your country code, usually 001-760-918-4300. And we're going to begin with our longtime listener, Dan in Philadelphia, who I met for the very first time in Philadelphia last weekend. Dan, welcome to the show. What are we going to talk about today?
Yes, hi, Michael. Thank you for this opportunity to talk with you. And I got to say, it was wonderful to meet you last Sunday.
Fantastic. So, yeah, what's on your mind?
Well, you've answered a lot of my questions. The line of thought that you offered in the beginning of the show has been really helpful. I noticed at the conference that my thinking was starting to speed up. And like you say, I have gratitude for fear in the frame that you've offered. Because if I had not stepped back after I was getting wind up in my thoughts this past Sunday at the conference, there's a chance I could have gotten kicked out or arrested or something, which has happened in the past before to me. And so I have that fear sometimes, but that fear is a blessing because, and that's what I'm getting out of this conversation right now. And so I just want to let you know that I'm eager to stay in the conversation, to interact with life, and to look for insights. And If there's any kind of feedback you have on that, that would be wonderful. And if not, I just wanted to offer my gratitude for fear and for all good things in the world. So,
well, thank you, Dan. I'll kind of give you a response off the air. So one of the things about, and I love what Dan said, is that he caught it, right? He saw it. He woke up to it. Right? That waking up, it's not something we have to do. It's in us. The alarm clocks are set. Right? One of my friends says, look, at some point you're going to wake up to the sheer volume of noise in your head. Now it may be when you die, right? That's actually one of the definitions of death, is it's the cessation of mental activity. But it's like there's a million alarm clocks between here and there. Right? And And one of the simplest ones is just what's going on in our body, right? The feeling of expansion or contraction in ourselves. And it's no big deal. We're designed to have a lot of give, right? Like when they make a bridge, you know, and part of how they make it to make it earthquake proof and wind proof is they put some give in it. So it can take some bowing. We can take a lot of expansion and contraction in ourselves. But we also have this beautiful built-in rumble strip. And when we start to feel scared, it's not telling us don't do it. It's not telling us do it. It's not telling us, ooh, this is important. It's just letting you know, hey, your thinking's going off the road a little bit. You might not want to keep thinking what you're thinking. And the nature of thought is, if you stop thinking what you're thinking, a new thought will come along in a minute. And if you don't like that thought, you can let that one go and there'll be different thinking along in a minute. Because you're not thinking now what you were thinking the last time I talked about that you don't know what you're going to be thinking 5 minutes from now. And you're not thinking now what you were thinking at the beginning of the show. And that's because the nature of thought is fluid, except for when we hold on to it and treat it like a solid. Let's go to, okay, now is this Roseville, Mississippi, Roseville, Michigan, or Roseville, Missouri? Kelly, where are you?
Hi, I'm in Roseville, Michigan.
Michigan, there you go. Well, welcome to the show. What are we going to talk about today?
Thanks for taking my call. I wanted to ask you about if you have fear regarding a very specific thing that always comes back up, like it's always anxiety around a certain subject, like work.
Mm-hmm.
And it feels like it's absolutely the subject matter that is causing the fear. So it really appears outside in, even though there's, you know, some things you understand in a way that it's inside out, but it doesn't seem that way.
So okay. First off, yeah, know those. In fact, that's the whole game, right? The reason that we're not all wise to this is because my friend Jack Pransky has a lovely way to talk about it. He talks about being seduced by consciousness, right? That the very aspect of the mind that allows us to experience life as if it's really happening from outside in, it makes our thinking seem so real that when we're in it, we don't even question it, right? But to say, to think that because you keep feeling fear when thinking the same fearful thoughts, that keeps being the content of it, to add significance to that is a little bit like saying, you know, why is it that every time I step on the squeaky step, it squeaks? Like, yeah, that's a habitual thought that you've got. And what that means is that it's possible to keep thinking one thought long enough that it becomes habitual. It doesn't mean it's more significant. It doesn't mean it's, ooh, there must be a real message here because I keep thinking it and feeling fear. It just means, yeah, that's, you got a habit of thinking that thought and feeling that feeling. Now, does that make any, like, does that have any resonance for you?
Yes.
So tell me about all the hesitation in that yes.
It's almost as if it's just so convincing that it's real, the thought.
Have you ever been to a hypnosis show?
No.
They're really kind of fun. One of my good friends, Paul McKenna, is a hypnotist in the UK. And you know, he convinces people that they're Mick Jagger and they dance about on stage. And, you know, he convinces people that a mop is the love of their life and they go dancing. And, you know, the mind, one of the things that the mind can do is convince itself of anything. But the other thing that it can do is wake up from the hypnosis, is wake up from the illusion that the mop is really the love of your life, that you're really Mick Jagger, or that whatever it is that you think about is really why you're feeling what you're feeling.
Okay.
So here's another way of kind of thinking about it. So most people, if they feel scared, the next question that you, what would, okay, if I said, I'm scared, what would be the first question that comes to mind for you?
What are you afraid of?
Right. So that's the reason that's the question we ask, is because that's how we think fear works. Something outside us can create an experience of fear inside us. So what are you afraid of seems like a really relevant question. But if the feeling of fear, as all feelings do, comes from thought in the moment, then what are you afraid of is just a question of, you know, what color t-shirt are you wearing today, blue or red?
Okay.
The fear itself. See, here's how I sometimes say it to clients. Like, we could work on your fear of this or your fear of that. But if you had a deeper understanding of fear, like if you could see fear for what it was, and you could see that first off, it's, you know, it doesn't control you, right? You don't have to be a victim of fear, because worst case, it's uncomfortable and then it passes. But secondly, you can get to the point where when fear came up in you, it just was as simple as the pain response when you sip a cup of coffee and it's too hot, right? And you just put it down and you let it sit for a minute, right? That's all it's doing. It's just letting you know, hey, that thought is a little hot right now. You might want to put that one down for later. And the beautiful thing about thought is that you don't have to go back to that same thought, because you can think anything. There's a world of fresh new thoughts you've never thought before about absolutely anything in this world. And that's what makes your world bigger than whatever version you've made up and struggle with.
That's good to know.
It is,
very
isn't
good
it?
To know. Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you, Kelly.
Thank you so much. And Michael, when is your next book going to be out on audio? Do you know?
Yes, it should be out. I'm going to say October 15th, if you promise not to beat me about the face if I'm off by a week or so. But it's coming soon. It's already recorded. It's already edited. We're just working out some details about the release.
Okay, great. Thank you so much. I love your books, and you're always such a huge help. Thank you.
Thank you, Kelly. So I'll pick up on that. So yeah, if you're interested in the audiobook, obviously I'll mention it, the audiobook of The Space Within. I'll mention it when it's out on the show, but you can also find out at michaelneal.org. If you're not already on the email list we send out every week, we send out you'll get the latest blog, you'll get the latest video, you'll get the latest podcast, and you'll get one of my favorite quotes. We put that out each week, and we'll also obviously let you know about things like cue imaginary music about every time I say creating the impossible, I hear da 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 da. But the Creating the Impossible program coming up in January 2017, but just literally came out today. So if you go to creatingtheimpossible.net, if you sign up today or in the next week, you will not only get a couple of $100 off the course, or a package that actually includes a whole creativity weekend that you can attend live in LA or live streaming over the internet in December. But we're also going to be releasing a longer form video every week from the time you book to the end of the program. And this first video is just a gorgeous talk that I gave back in March with a woman named Mara Gleason from an organization called One Solution. She's going to be speaking at the Unlimited Conference in Helsinki with me. And the talk is called, Can You Really Change the World in Just 2 Hours? And I don't know, people who've seen it so far really, really like it. And that's the first video that's available when you book onto Creating the Impossible. So let's talk a little bit more, shall we, about this whole notion of the thought-feeling connection and the whole idea that maybe fear isn't what we think it is. Like, in fact, in my TEDx talk in Why Aren't We Awesomer, I talk about how one of the most dramatic experiences that I ever had around just seeing how made up fear is was when I went on a television show called Put It to the Test in the United Kingdom. And the point of the television show, the woman who hosted it, Carol Vorderman, was she was sort of the British Vanna White, except she was really intelligent and drank tea. No offense, Vanna, you may be very intelligent and drink tea too, but that was just my image of the two of them growing up. And so the idea behind the show was that they would take these ideas and put them to the test on the show and see if they were true. And so I tell the story that the thing before me, the feature before me, was to see if a car could really stop on a dime. I seem to remember it was actually a truck even. And in fact, they like put a dime on the road and it did. They were able to, in fact, stop it on a dime, which was quite cool. And I was on there to demonstrate the NLP fast phobia cure, which essentially can take people who are phobic and no matter what they're phobic of, anything from spiders to snakes to jello, which is one of the weirdest phobias I've ever seen, but I've met a couple of people who have jello phobias, that just the phobia is gone. And the reason that it worked in my mind at the time, and I'd done it hundreds of times, so I knew that it worked, but my understanding at that time, I didn't really see that everything is made of thought. I just could see, oh, well, a phobia is made of thought. And so if you change the thought, the phobia has to change. So they hook up three people. They bring three people into studio, one of whom I actually had met before, two of whom I'd never met before, who had full-on spider phobias. And during the show, they brought out tarantulas, and they had these people hooked up to EEG and EKG machines, and they had doctors monitoring it. It all looked very cool. And they freaked out, as you would expect them to. And then I worked with them, and they came back and hooked them back up to the machines and brought the spiders back out. And even in a couple cases, when they took the spider out of the box and somebody held it, they didn't have anything like the physiological response of fear that they'd had before. Now, that was cool, right? And it made for great TV. But the thing about it that really got me was the dress rehearsal. Because in the dress rehearsal, the stage manager, they're hooked up to the machines, and the stage manager comes out in a very kind of bored voice, goes, okay, so, and she's holding a clear plastic box, right? A clear, empty plastic box. And she said, okay, so during the show, she was British. I don't know why I'm giving her a sort of a Jersey accent here, but just bear with me. During the show, we're going to have spiders in here. And all three of their EKG machines and EEG machines went crazy. And they were having full-blown phobic responses, full-blown panic attacks at the mention of what would at some point be inside a clear plastic box. And for me, that made it apparent in a way I'd never seen it so obviously, that we're not afraid of something. We're not afraid of what we think we're afraid of. We're afraid of what we think. And no matter what you think, no matter how long you've thought the same thoughts, you don't have to think that. In fact, in any moment, you can let go of that thought. You drop thought all day long. Right? You'll have some kind of crazy thought come into your head when you're working, and you'll just go, oh, God, whatever. You know, ooh, what if the Martians invade? Oh, look, I'm working. You know, ooh, what's for dinner? Ugh, okay, look, 20 minutes. I'll feed you in 20 minutes. Right? You know, we're used to dropping thought. But the reason that we don't drop our fear thoughts is because we think they're important. We think they're meaningful. We think they're warning us about something. We think they're protecting us or preparing us. And they're not. They're just letting us know, hey, you're going off the rails a little bit here. You're a little bit lost. You probably want to want to pull back. You probably want to open yourself up to fresh thought. And the beautiful thing is, the second you do that, it makes space. Now, that space is already there, right? That space is always there. But you go back to the space within. You go back to a wider band of consciousness, right? More bandwidth. And in that increased bandwidth, in that wider space of consciousness, new thought comes along. And the new thought that comes along inevitably has more wisdom in it. Right? The new thought that comes along has more intelligence behind it. The new thought that comes along is often what we would describe or experience as creative. It's fresh. It's insightful. It has a different quality to it than the thinking that we're used to. And if you know there's, you know, that if you let go of what you're thinking now, there'll be a better thought along in a minute, it turns out to not be so hard to just step back from what you're thinking now. Let's go back to the phones. Let's speak with Rachel in Quincy. Hey, Rachel, what are we going to talk about today?
Hi, I'm calling because I actually just tuned into your show, and it's almost by nature that I'm hearing you speak. So I've been suffering with OCD, intrusive thoughts, for about 6 years, more of a milder case. It's not debilitating to me, but mm-hmm. every now and then I have these thoughts and I just completely get locked down with fear. And so after a recent experience with trying an SSRI that I just had a very bad reaction to, I've kind of put my foot down and said, you know what? I don't want to live like this anymore. I don't want to do this. I'm done. And the hard thing, everything you're saying is making just a lot of sense in terms of, you know, when the thoughts come in, they're only meaningful because you're giving them power to be meaningful. But what I have a hard time with is when these thoughts come in and I can't stop myself to kind of take that break to say, hey, okay, I recognize that this is going on. It just pulls me into that physical piece of anxiety, and wanted to look to see how do you recommend, like, kind of stopping that?
So here's what I'm guessing you haven't quite seen that is true. So let me paint a scenario and you tell me whether it's your experience. Yeah. You okay with that?
Yeah.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Yeah. All right. So you get caught up in some thinking and it looks really real to you. It doesn't look like thinking, doesn't even occur. Or maybe it looks, you kind of know it's thinking, but it doesn't help to know that it's thinking because you can't do anything about it. And then at some point, and sometimes you're aware of it and sometimes you're not, you pop out of it. Like waking up from a dream or like a fever breaking. And you kind of find yourself back to yourself. Is that true or not true?
No.
Okay, so great. So tell me your version of it. How is it that you're not in it 24/7?
Sure. So I would, in sort of the self-discovery, right, I've realized the root of my problem is, or my fear, is that I'm going to lose control in one way, shape, or form. And so thoughts, I will hear something on TV or I will think of something and I literally get sucked into that thought of, I'm going crazy, what's wrong with me, I must be losing my mind,
right.
Something's wrong, and I'm constantly seeking justification from family members, from anybody.
Sorry, Rachel, but that's the in. I'm talking about the out, because at some point you come out of it.
So, but the way I've been coming out of it is through medication, is through taking an Ativan to kind of bring me from where I am to bringing me down. And not that that's a bad thing, but I want to train myself to not have to take that, to be able to logistically think things through and be like, okay.
So it's okay if your answer to this is yes, right? I don't need you to please me, right? But. Are there really never times where you just pop out of it?
No.
No. Okay.
I get so locked with fear that I end up, I can't, I just become terrified.
Okay. So that's, first off, that sounds very sucky. That would be the technical term. Now, let me ask it a little differently, because I, given that you're a human and not a squirrel, I've never met a human that this isn't true for, so let me try a different one. Are there times where maybe it doesn't go that far down the line, but you get caught up in your thinking and then you pop out of it?
Occasionally.
Okay.
I mean, one or two times, yeah.
Okay, great. So here's why I really wanted to make sure that you see that that can happen. Because that's actually the system working perfectly when that happens, right? The system working perfectly isn't that we don't get caught up. It's that we wake up to it at a certain point in the game.
Mm.
So it sounds like, and this is, you know, I'm not a psychiatrist, psychologist, right? So, you know, anything that sounds vaguely like medical advice, please ignore, unintended, legal disclaimers galore, right? But as a human being who thinks, right, that's my qualification, right? And who used to think a lot painfully and now doesn't. What's really been interesting in my own life is seeing that the very, we always wake up, right? Like if you think of nighttime sleep, nighttime thinking. Right? At a certain point, we always wake up from nighttime sleeping.
Mm-hmm.
That's built into the system. And waking up from our own day thinking, our daymares, right? That's part of the system too. Now, if at the moment you find in your knowing, in your wisdom, that, that popping an Ativan at a certain point in the process kind of helps you wake up, then I'm not saying that's bad. I'm not saying that's wrong. I'm not saying, no, you mustn't do that, because that might be perfect. But whether or not you do that along the way, whether or not for somebody else, instead of an Ativan, it might be a drink. For somebody else, it might be going for a walk instead of an Ativan. For somebody else, it might be putting the TV on instead of going for a walk. For somebody else, it might be getting into conversation with a friend instead of putting the TV on.
Mm-hmm.
But we all intuitively find a way to wake ourselves up when we get caught up.
Mm.
And so the kind of the direction I would point you, and this isn't for what it's worth, Rachel, right? Because I get this, you know, is the more you see, I'm going to wake up from this, whether it's after an Ativan or after I distract myself with TV or after a walk or after a nap or whatever it is. But I'm going to wake up, because that's what our consciousness does for us. It wakes us up from the hypnosis. It wakes us up from the dream. The sooner you'll start to see it happen.
Yeah.
It's almost like the consciousness itself is what pushes forward the alarm clock.
Yes, and that makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah, and what I'd love, if you're up for it, is just kind of play with that this week and phone back into the show and let me know what you notice.
Yeah, no, I definitely will.
All right. Fantastic. All right, thank you.
Thank you so much.
You know, that's the look, this is the bear of thought, of thinking, is we can get so lost in it, and it can hurt so bad that we really feel like we gotta do something about it. And mostly, in my experience, the best thing we can do is see it more clearly, is wake up to it. And people always go, well, how do I do that? I don't know how to answer that, because it's not really you that does it. But it's almost like knowing, hey, there's a part of me that has my back here. And it may You know, I may have overridden it for years. I may have ignored it. I may not have noticed it. But it's built into the software. It's built into the firmware. It's built into the human design. It's part of the kindness of the design. Is you don't have to worry about falling asleep, because something in you will wake you up. And you don't have to worry about getting caught up in thought, even fearful thought, because there's something within you. There's a consciousness within you, a wisdom within you, that will always wake you up sooner or later. Let's squeeze one more in. Let's go out to Ontario and talk to Nina. Nina, welcome to the show. What are we going to talk about today?
Thank you so much for taking my call. I was attacked by a dog when I was 7 years old, and I've had a dog phobia ever since. As soon as I'm in close proximity with a dog, or even hear that there's a dog around or anything like that, I get a fight or flight response in my body without even, before I can even think to calm myself down. And it's very automatic, and it's really embarrassing at times, and it's really limiting at other times when I go to the beach or something. There's all dogs running around. So I just want to see if you can give me some pointers on how to deal with
I mean, one of the things, and dog food, my, funnily enough, my son was bitten by a dog, but when he was seven, quite badly. And interestingly, he didn't develop a phobia of dogs at all, but he just developed a phobia of not getting bitten. I mean, he didn't, I don't even know what I'm saying. It's like he didn't like it, but it didn't turn into anything. But what I've learned in all the years that I worked with phobias was that essentially the first thing is calling it a phobia. It is an accurate psychological term. It's an accurate psychological description. What it is it's an example of one-time learning, right? So your brain generalizes from one example and goes, okay, anything that looks like that, anything that fits the larger category, dog, avoid. Right? So it's like your own self-protection mechanism run amok. Does that make sense?
Correct. Yep.
Yeah. So there's two different ways that I've found that people find very helpful with phobias. So the way that I used to work with people is we would go in and we would mess with it. Right? So when in order to actually experience a feeling, you have to have thought. And so we would go in and kind of have people notice what they're thinking, because you don't notice what you're thinking when you're thinking it. You're just in it.
Sure.
Right? You're in the full-blown response. And we would have them do things like run it backwards, like run the thinking backwards, like a movie with, you know, circus music. And we would do all this stuff to mess with it until it just made it harder for their brain to think the same habitual thought in response to the same habitual stimulus. So that's the sort of nuts and bolts of the phobia cure. But what I found in the ensuing years, as I've seen more and more about the nature of thought, is that when people wake up to the thought-feeling connection, when they wake up to the fact that a feeling, even one that feels overwhelming, is still just made of this temporary energy of thought, they lose their fear of the fear. And when you lose your fear of the fear, it doesn't hit you the same way. And at some point, it just kind of falls away, and you might occasionally kind of have a little start when you hear a dog bark. But that's it. Because that health in us kind of rebalances the system. It recalibrates the self-protection mechanism, so that we're still able to protect ourselves if there's a clear and present danger, but we don't pre-protect ourselves before anything could actually happen. So one to sit with, one to think about and play with. And if you haven't watched it, I do recommend check out my TEDx talk, Why Aren't We Awesomer? And I have a couple of stories in there that you might find helpful.
Okay, great. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Nina. Thank you all for listening. We have come to the end of another beautiful show. We check out Creating the Impossible Net to take advantage of the special offers on Creating the Impossible. But till next time, have fun, learn heaps, and I'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye for now.